all about food. The title of her talk is What to Eat, Personal Responsibility or Social Responsibility. And Marion Nessel is a professor at NYU, I believe. Yes, she's a professor at NYU, and she's also the author of several books, including Food Politics, Safe Food, and What to Eat. And here we go, a talk by Marion Nessel.
Let me start by saying that I think we're in the middle of a food revolution, and you're right at the forefront of it. When Time magazine has an article about the Niman Ranch, and you know, Time magazine is kind of right-wing, or at least it represents corporate America, and then The Nation, a week later, has an issue on how the food revolution is growing democracy. I think that says it all. I mean, this is really on the public agenda in a way that it has never, that I've never seen it before. My own work deals with food systems, from production to consumption. And by that, I mean the interaction between agriculture, food, nutrition, and public health. And the two aspects of public health that I've been most interested in are obesity and food safety. And these don't seem like they're necessarily related, but you can't ask people to eat healthier food if that food gives them E. coli or salmonella and they get really sick or die. So they are, in fact, very closely related, in part because the forces that are behind the issues around obesity and food safety are really quite similar. And I'm going to say something about both of them today. My starting point always is public confusion about what it is that they're supposed to be eating. The public is demonstrably confused. Some of it has to do with the research. Some of it has to do with media. Some of it has to do with just confusion in the marketplace. But I think the confusion is really unfortunate because you don't need to be a genius to figure out what it is you're supposed to be eating. In fact, it's so simple I can summarize it on one slide. And I have to say, Michael Pollan, who's a much better writer than I am, did this in 7 words, and it took me 15. But my mantra is eat less, move more, eat plenty of fresh fruits and vegetables. They don't have to be fresh. Fruits, vegetables, and whole grain. Don't eat too much junk food. Some junk food's okay. Just don't eat too much of it. Enjoy what you're eating, and please don't eat my book. If it seems more complicated than that, it's surely because of the effect of this kind of advice on the food industry. And this was beautifully expressed by an executive of Coca-Cola a couple of years ago who gave an interview with Advertising Age in which she said this astounding thing about obesity. It's our Achilles heel. We never used to have to worry about obesity, and now it just absolutely dominates every discussion we have. It's a huge, huge issue. So it's not only a huge issue for people who might be gaining weight, it's also a huge issue for the food industry. And the reason for that has to do with the fact that obesity is not necessarily, it's not only a cosmetic problem, it's not a cosmetic problem. It raises the risk for chronic disease. And I want to make it really clear that not everyone who is overweight is going to get type 2 diabetes. In fact, the percentage of type 2 diabetes, even among people who are overweight, is really quite small. But it is going up in parallel with rising rates of obesity. And the big concern, of course, is that it's going to affect children, because children with type 2 diabetes will have a lifetime of medical treatment, and we don't exactly have a consumer-friendly healthcare system in this country. So this is a big problem for society. So if obesity is a problem, what are we going to do about it? And there are two approaches to dealing with it. The first is the personal responsibility approach, beautifully expressed by The Economist, with a statement that, you know, I just thought was amazing. If people want to eat their way to grossness in an early grave, let them. If they're fat, it's their fault. And as a public health professional, if I believe that personal responsibility is responsible for the way people eat, the remedy is very simple. All I have to do is teach people what's healthy for them, and they'll do it, right? They won't do it, unfortunately, as any of you have tried nutrition education will probably know. And the reason for that has to do with the fact that we live in what the New York Times called a gorge yourself environment, an environment in which there's too much food, too many choices, and too much eating. And here, as a public health professional, the remedy is to change society. To change society in order to make it easier for people to make more healthful choices. And that, I think, is what we're about. Okay, if we're going to change society, the question is, what is it about society that needs to change? You may be able to think of a few things, but let's just talk about obesity here. And if we want to talk about changing society, we have to talk about the way that society changed. People didn't always used to be overweight and fat at the levels that they are now. In fact, for decades and decades and decades, up until the early 1980s, the percentage of overweight people in America stayed about the same. It was about 15%. Starting in the early 1980s, the percentages started to go up, and they went up quite dramatically. So the obvious question is, what happened in the early 1980s that either made people eat more or move less? I'm not going to be talking about the moving less part of this, because even though I think that activity is really important, because there's very little evidence that people are less active now than they were in the early 1980s. But there is an enormous amount of evidence that people are eating more. So the question then becomes, why did people start eating more in the early 1980s? And I think there are three reasons, or at least there are actually lots of reasons, but I think there are three main ones. The first one is always to blame moms. It's a useful thing to do when you don't know what else to do. The idea is that women started going back into the workforce, thereby creating an enormous demand for convenience. But if you look at the actual data on this, women started going back into the workforce in the early 1950s. By 1980, which is when all this started, a large proportion of women were already back. This may be part of the explanation, but it's certainly not the whole explanation. A more important one, I think, is agricultural policy, and this is the way in which agriculture and nutrition are related. Farm policy changed in the 1970s in a switch from paying farmers to restrict the amount of food they grew to paying farmers to grow as much food as they possibly could, some farmers. And the result of that was mountains of corn in a sea of farm subsidies that no administration, Democratic or Republican, has been able to get rid of. What that did was to increase the number of calories available in the food supply. And what you see here in that pink band that goes across the slide is the average number of calories that were available in the food supply per capita, man, woman, and child, was about 3,200 per capita per day for decades and decades and decades, almost 100 years since the Department of Agriculture first started measuring this. Starting in the early 1980s, that shifted and went up. As farmers were producing more food, the number of calories available in the food supply, and this isn't what people are eating necessarily, this is what's available, less exports plus imports, went from 3,200 a day to the present 4,000 calories a day available, which is roughly twice average need. Even with the amount of calories that the Department of Agriculture says is wasted, it's still far more than anybody needs. We're talking men, women, little tiny babies here. So what this did was make the food industry enormously competitive. If you're a food company trying to sell a food product in this kind of environment, you're trying to push your product into a food environment in which there's twice as many calories as anybody needs. So you're very competitive. But that wasn't all that happened. Starting in the early 1980s, we had the advent of what is called the shareholder value movement, which was attributed to Jack Welch, who was then the head of General Electric, and he gave a speech in 1981 in which he said, enough of this blue chip stock stuff. That is, stocks that gave very, very long-term, slow but steady returns on investment. As investors, we want higher returns on investment right now. And the result of that was that Wall Street changed the way that it evaluated companies, all companies, and we're seeing the results of that in on Wall Street right now. But for food companies, it was a particularly difficult situation because they were already trying to sell their food products and make money in an environment in which there was an enormous overabundance of food. Now they not only had to make a profit, but they had to grow their profits every 90 days. And the result of that was that companies changed society. In order to find outlets for selling more food, they changed society in ways that nobody even noticed. And for the next several slides, I'm going to go through some of the ways in which society changed since the early 1980s. Every time you see an exclamation point, that shorthand for if you're doing that, you're going to be eating more calories than you would if you were eating at home. So food outside the home. Because there was such an abundance of food, the price went down, people ate out more. If you eat in a restaurant, you're going to eat more food than you would if you were serving yourself at home. I ate a salad at a restaurant in Bar Harbor this afternoon that I thought would have served four easily. I didn't eat all of it, but I thought it would have served four. Larger portions, and that was exactly what that was about. This is my former doctoral student, now Dr. Lisa Young, and her thesis defense in which she, her thesis was about measuring the size of portions in the food supply. The white cup on the left is a Department of Agriculture standard serving size for soft drink. It holds 8 ounces, and that's 100 calories. The one on the right is a double gulp that holds 64 ounces, 800 calories. And the evidence shows that that cup, that large cup, is not passed down the aisle in the movie theater and shared among everyone who's sitting there. It's consumed by one person. It's very interesting. I wrote something on my blog, foodpolitics.com, yesterday about soft drinks and said that they ought to label these things with 800 calories. And somebody wrote in and said, you're being really misleading. Nobody drinks 800 calories worth of soft drinks at a time. This person may not, but people do. I don't. You might. On the portion size, one of the things about the business with portion size is if there was one thing that I could teach America, it would be that larger portions have more calories. Let me tell you, it's not intuitively obvious. And that was proven by Brian Wansink, who's a very clever professor at Cornell. And what I'm showing here is his famous Super Bowl experiment, in which he invited his own students, who should have known better, to come to his house and watch the Super Bowl with him, one of America's big eating occasions. And he put half of them in one room with 2-quart bowls of popcorn and the other half in another room with 4-quart bowls of popcorn. At the end, he counted up the number of calories from popcorn that they had eaten and discovered, not to his surprise, that the ones with the 4-quart bowls had eaten almost twice as many calories as the ones with the 2-quart bowls. And when he asked them how many calories they had eaten, they underestimated the number of calories they were eating by a much greater extent. It is not intuitively obvious that larger portions have more calories. Large portions encourage people to eat more calories and to underestimate the amount of calories that they're eating. You don't need another explanation for gaining weight. Ubiquity is another. I like to ask the question, when did it become okay to eat in bookstores? I promise you that prior to the mid-1980s, you could not bring a food into a bookstore. And now every bookstore has a cafe in it, and maybe your library does too. Proximity is another one, and one of the reasons why nutritionists like me are so upset about vending machines in schools is that the research shows that the more vending machines you have, the more products kids buy from them. And if you want to do something about school lunches, one of the first things you have to do is get rid of the vending machines. The last one is the cheap food. And Adam Drnowski and his colleagues in Seattle have done a really terrific work showing how many calories a dollar can buy. And this graphic shows that with $1, you can buy 1,200 calories worth of potato chips or 170 calories of fresh fruit. which is another way of looking at the higher cost of fruits and vegetables relative to the cost of junk food. And these pricing strategies have a great deal to do with our agricultural policy, as many of you have been talking about today. So these are the kinds of things that Michelle Simon talked about in her terrific book, Appetite for Profit, which, if you don't know about it, I think you'll be really interested to see it, in which is kind of a manual about how to fight the food industry. And she talks about the pressures on food companies from advocates, from regulators who are dying to regulate them, from lawyers who are dying to sue them, and from Wall Street that simply wants them to make more money every 90 days. And food companies reacted by going through all the stages of death and denial. They did nothing, they denied, then they began fighting back. And I'm not going to say very much about the fighting back. You can go on my website, I post all their letters. But they lobby government to be exempt from laws. They attack advocates. That's what those letters are about. They blame physical activity for the problem and blame personal choice. I'm not going to discuss those. What I am going to talk about is the way in which they're changing products. And I want to talk specifically about health claims, functional foods, and self-endorsements, which are big, all three of which are big issues right now. First of all, health claims. We didn't have health claims on food products until 1990. The Nutrition Labeling Act that put the nutrition facts label on food products made food companies scream to Congress that this was unfair. If they had to say what was bad about their products, Congress should let them say what was good about their products. So that Congress agreed and for the first time forced the FDA to begin allowing health claims. And the FDA said it would permit health claims that had a reasonable amount of scientific substantiation. And the cereals that I've shown here are health claims that were approved by the FDA because there was some science behind them. So that the oats and Cheerios may reduce the risk of heart disease. I thought, you know, never mind. Oatmeal may help reduce cholesterol, and this soy energy cereal may reduce the risk of heart disease and some cancers. If you just think of it for a second, you know that if eating Cheerios isn't going to do very much for you, but never mind. Over the years, since the early 1990s, when health claims were allowed, companies that were turned down by the FDA for health claims took the FDA to court, and the courts generally ruled in favor of the companies on the grounds of the First Amendment and freedom of speech, and the FDA gave up, under the Bush administration, gave up regulating health claims. And the result is just a complete cacophony of health claims in the supermarket. I'm going to be showing you a lot of cereal boxes, not because I love cereal so much, but because the cereal companies are right at the cutting edge of marketing. And if you want to know what's going on with food marketing, you go to the cereal aisle first. So here's a Kellogg cereal with six different kinds of health claims on it. It's got little tokens that talk about the nutritional value. It'll make you smart. It'll make your heart healthy. It has 0 grams of trans fat. I'm so relieved. It will lower both your blood pressure and cholesterol, and it has an endorsement from the American Heart Association, despite the fact that sugars appear 9 times in the ingredient list. Now, the American Heart Association only cares about fat and cholesterol, doesn't care about sugar. So I don't think the American Heart Association should be doing this, but they get paid for it. So that's their decision. The next issue I want to talk about is the functional food business, because this is the hot new area in food marketing. And a functional food is something that has something added to it over and above its basic nutritional value. And vitamin water is kind of the best example of that. This is water and sugar and whatever else the company was brilliant enough to put into it. I met the person who was the originator of vitamin water. He was totally sincere in thinking that he was going to help improve the health of Americans with this. And I'm sure he was really happy when he was bought out by Coca-Cola, which now owns this. But functional foods, this is where marketing is going, and it's the only thing besides organics that are selling processed foods. Now, in 2008, omega-3 fats were put into absolutely everything. they were put into milk and peanut butter and mayonnaise and Oreo-type cookies. But omega-3s were so 2008. We are now in 2009 when we're talking about calcium and vitamin D. And then this astonishing Cocoa Krispies with a 2-inch high immunity banner across it because it's got some vitamins in it. And you'll start seeing these on cereal boxes more and more. I was fascinated by an ad for Juicy Juice, which is a sweetened juice drink. It isn't even juice, it's a juice drink. Clearly meant for toddlers because it's got a sippy cup, right? And it's got omega-3s in one of them, and it says right on the front of it, brain development. And on the other one, it's immunity. So if you give this sweetened juice drink to your toddler's going to be smarter, right? So this whole thing raises what I think is a really important philosophical question, and it's one that my nutritionist colleagues debate all the time, which is a better-for-you product, that is, a product that has some added nutrient or something like that in it, really a good choice? When what you really want is you really want kids eating fruits and vegetables. So that brings me to the whole question of marketing to children, because you can argue that adults are adults, and one of the really great things about being an adult is you get to eat anything you want, anytime you want it, so there. But with kids, it's different, and the Institute of Medicine in December 2005 did this really big study on food marketing to children and youth, in which they looked at 123 studies on the effects of marketing on kids. And they also examined the research enterprise that's devoted to teaching companies how to market to kids, the methods that are used to sell kids foods, the amount of money that's spent to market to kids, and so forth and so on. And they came up with all of the conclusions that you would guess. Marketing works, and it works really, really well. And here's some of how much money is spent on marketing to kids is a big debate. Some books have said that it's $7 or $8 billion a year. The Federal Trade Commission last year said it was only $2 billion a year. I don't know. Those numbers are too big for me to understand anyway. And it's very hard to get these kinds of figures for individual products, but Advertising Age has an issue once a year in which it breaks out some products. And Kellogg spent $66.1 million in 2008 just on media advertising that went through advertising agencies just on Frosted Flakes, $19 million for Pop-Tarts, and nearly $11 million for Fruit Loops. Any nationally advertised cereal has a budget at that level behind it. And, you know, if you compare that to what the federal government spends on nutrition education, we're not even in the same stratosphere here. Now, why would companies want to spend that extraordinary amount of money on marketing to kids who don't have much money of their own? There are three reasons. The first is brand loyalty. The idea is if you get your kid hooked on Coke early in life, that child will never drink Pepsi, even though tests have shown that nobody can tell the difference. You think you can. But if in blind tests, nobody can tell the difference. The second one is the pester factor. And you know what? You have an intuitive feel for what that is. All you have to do is watch a two-year-old in a supermarket. And that's what it's called in the marketing to kids industry. The object of the game is not only to get kids to ask their parents to buy the product, but also for them to do it intelligently and give reasons for why they want to, you know, good reasons for doing it. And that brings me to the third issue, which is the one that really troubles me a lot. And that is the whole point of marketing to kids is to get kids to think that they're supposed to eat kids' food. They're supposed to eat food that's made for them in packages with cartoons on them, in funny shapes and colors, unidentified food objects. They're supposed to eat kids' food. And whenever I hear an adult say, gee, we can't feed kids healthy food because the kids won't eat it, I know that we're seeing food marketing to kids aimed at kids' food in action, and I can see how effective it is. So let me go on to the third one, which is the self-endorsement. Starting about 5 or 6 years ago, companies like PepsiCo began putting these little green spots on products to identify which of their products were the healthiest. And the way this worked, it's really very clever. The way this worked was the companies set up their own nutritional criteria and then applied those criteria to their own products. And by some astonishing miracle, hundreds of their products qualified. And the this is the better for you theory. This is the, if you asked PepsiCo executives, as I did, you're marketing these things as health foods. They said, no, 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 you're being cynical. We're just marketing them as better for you options. Remember, a better-for-you choice is not necessarily a good choice. Now, PepsiCo wasn't the only company that did that. All of the big companies did that. Here is a Kraft Sensible Solution marked product, a Lunchable. And what this means is that this is a better-for-you choice than other Lunchables, even though it's got a full ounce of sugar and of sugars and meats, and already is 25% of the day's allotment of sodium and of saturated fat for an adult, let alone a kid. So, okay, there's problems with this. But what happens if nutritionists independently develop nutrition criteria? And that experiment was done by Hannaford Supermarkets, which those of you who live around here know about because they're all over the place here. Hannaford, for reasons that I still don't understand, recruited a group of independent nutrition scientists to come up with rigorous nutritional criteria for evaluating products in the store. And the idea was that the foods that passed those criteria would be awarded 1, 2, or 3 gold stars. And that consumers could come into the store and just grab the ones that had 3 stars and know that they were getting something really healthy. To their dismay, they discovered when they applied these rigorous criteria to 27,000 products, only 23% of the products in the store qualified for even 1 star. But that's not all. Of that 23%, 80% were fruits and vegetables in the produce section. So what that tells you is that if you have reasonable nutrition criteria, very, very few processed foods get through the screen. Now, that's important because of what's happening in Great Britain, where there's been a move afoot to put traffic signals on food products. And I was in Great Britain in August, and I went to a Waitrose and I picked up this mozzarella and roast tomato wrap, which has 2 red lights, 1 yellow light, and 1 green light, and 500 calories, roughly. The idea here is you put a green light on products that are healthier, the yellow ones are okay, and the red ones are a strong suggestion that you probably should leave it on the shelf. And in fact, that's what's happening. So the research shows that where the traffic light system is in place, consumers are not buying the ones with the red marks on them. That is why American food companies got together to come up with a different kind of labeling system called Smart Choices. And the Smart Choices is interesting because it's a collaboration between a large number of major food companies and 4 nutrition organizations, or 3 nutrition organizations in the American Heart Association. And I'm embarrassed to say that the American Society of Nutrition, which is an organization of nutrition researchers to which I belong, is managing this program. And they set up their criteria. I thought the criteria were rather generous. You could have up to 25% of the calories from sugars and up to 480 milligrams of sodium per serving. But even then, I didn't realize what was happening. And I was asked by a reporter for the New York Times to go to a supermarket with him. And the first product we spotted with a check mark was this one. So here's Fruit Loops with a Smart Choices check mark on it. And it doesn't have 25% of the calories from sugar. It's got 44% of the calories from sugar because they make an exception for cereals. So here we have a a product with this check mark on it that's 40% of the weight of the product is sugar. Sugar is the first ingredient by weight, and this is the first of these check mark products. Now, this, of course, caused some hilarity in the press, and this reporter for the New York Times got, I understand that there are some students from Tufts here. This reporter got the dean of the School of Nutrition at Tufts to explain that Fruit Loops was a better choice of a breakfast than a donut. And the, which is one of the people on my blog said, maybe the program should be called Better Than a Donut. And last week's Economist had this wonderful picture of this child with a heading, It's Practically Spinach. I mean, this is ludicrous and a source of great embarrassment. And you Tufts students, I want to hear about what's going on at Tufts. So here's the environment that we live in where we have, you know, government, industry, and sometimes health and nutrition professionals creating an environment that encourages people to eat more than they need or want. Okay, that's on the obesity side. Let me say just a few things about, oops, one more on this, just to let you know, this is not just American. I was in Panama in January, and I picked up this, I mean, Kellogg's is right at the cutting edge. Here's chocolate sweetie cereals in Panama with an endorsement from the Pediatric Association of Guatemala. This is a worldwide phenomenon. Okay, let me say a few words about food safety. Food safety's changed in the United States from when it used to be a problem of leftover Thanksgiving turkey and deviled eggs at church picnics. We're now dealing with the two most important food safety problems, I believe, which are food insecurity in the world, people not having enough to eat, and obesity and its consequences. But then we have these nasty microbes that we didn't used to have.
Alrighty then, I appear to be having some technical difficulties, so I guess we'll end that talk by Marion Nessel for today, and I will play the rest of it next week on this show, Your Homegrown Food. And if you'd like to see the entire speech by Marion Nessel, I found it on YouTube, but you can also find a link to it on my Facebook page, which is Your Homegrown Food Show. I put up a link there. And if you'd like to get any more information or get information about anything else I've talked about on the show, or if you'd like to leave me a message, or you'd like to suggest a topic for this show, or you'd like to be a guest, or you'd like to suggest some music related to food that I could play on the show, then you can send me an email at yourhomegrownfood@gmail.com. You can go to my Facebook page, like I said, Your Homegrown Food Show on Facebook, or you can also look at my website, yourhomegrownfood.com. And you can tune in Your Homegrown Food every Wednesday at 11:30. I'm here on the air talking about food or playing different clips and reading news about food. I like to talk specifically about the alternative food movement. As Marion Nessel said, she feels there's a food revolution happening, and I'm trying to bring that sort of information to you every week at 11:30 here on this station, Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM and freakradio.org on the internet. And that wraps up the show for today. So come back by next Wednesday at 11:30 and you can hear the remainder of this talk by Marion Nessel that I played the first half of. It's about an hour long, so I'll play the second half for you next week. And if you would like to donate to our station, Free Radio, you can do that by going to our website, freakradio.org, and you can pay, make a donation by PayPal, or you can send your donation to FRSC, P.O. Box 7811, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. And the reason we like your donations is because this is a completely volunteer-run station, and all of our operations happen by donation. Mostly, programmers' donations, and so it really helps if the listeners join in and help us out. And if you'd like to become a programmer and have a show on this station, you can do so by going to our website, freakradio.org, and find out more about how you can do that. Because I think we could use more programmers on this station, get some more good information out to all the listeners. So that's the end of our show for today, and I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Free Radio has a problem. Free Radio has been evicted. The landlord